Welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. My name is Keith Bradshaw. I'm the Hong Kong Bureau Chief for the New York Times International Herald Tribune. I'll be your host today. We have a very interesting speaker, but first, a few housekeeping details. First of all, please, everybody, turn off your cell phones now, including the press in the back there. Please check. We don't want any beeps or other noises during the speech. If everybody checks now, we won't have that. And I know the television people in particular appreciate not having that kind of sound over their signal. Second of all, I'd like to mention some of the upcoming events we have. Next Monday, we have Christine Lowe, whom many of you may know, from Civic Exchange. She's going to be talking about a subject people seldom hear much about in Hong Kong, which is who is a member of the Chinese Communist Party here, and why does it choose to remain a secret party in the Marxist-Leninist tradition in an otherwise open democracy here. Then on the 11th of March, we have Ramachandra Guha. He's one of India's most prominent intellectuals and writers these days, and he will be talking about why India must not and will not become a superpower. That one's already sold out, but if you want to put your names on the waiting list, you can do so downstairs. And then Peter Hessler, the author of The Oracle Bones, will be speaking here on the 22nd, I'm sorry, on the 18th of March, and he'll be speaking on the evolution of how the West sees China. Last month, many of you may have come to another lunch we had at which Philip Carmichael, the president of Asia Operations for Haier, the world's largest appliance company, talked about how Haier had done and how China had done, and he had a rather provocative statement. He said, China took a pass on the global recession. Now, a year ago, very few people thought that China would be able to take a pass on the global recession. And it looked as though a decline in world demand would really result in a serious hiccup for the Chinese economy. But the Chinese economy seems to have bounced back very quickly. One of the people who stayed bullish a year ago when she spoke here at the club was Jing Ulrich, and at a time when a lot of people were not. And she's here today to give us an update on her views. She is the managing director and chairman of China Equities and Commodities at J.P. Morgan. Ms. Ulrich.
Good afternoon, everyone. Keith, thank you very much for hosting me. It's always good to see the friendly faces at the FCC. Actually, Keith and Tom, I think we have a very learned audience today. So I'd like to begin by taking a simple poll. So everyone, when you hear my question, yes or no, you raise your hand, please. How many people here think we have a property bubble in China? How many? Raise your hand if you think. See, quite a lot. How many people think the non-performing loans problem in China will get worse? That's nearly the entire audience. And thirdly, how many people think the central government's tightening measures will continue for the rest of 2010? So if this room is any indication, I think market sentiment has already changed. A year ago, almost exactly to the day I was standing here at the FCC, I said at the time, China could maintain its 8% GDP growth despite the worst recession in many decades. I also said the reason why I sincerely believed China could achieve its growth target was because of a unique combination, and that is unlimited financial resources and extremely strong political determination. Now, a year later, market sentiment has changed. Also, the exuberance that we saw only a few months ago has pretty much given way to overriding concern about policy changes and the side effects of last year's extraordinary credit binge. Now, the pervasive market worry at this point is that China's economic recovery may actually lose some steam at a time when the stock market and the property market are going through a correction. A number of the prominent commentators have already said that China's credit growth has been too excessive, there are asset bubbles forming, and thus this is fueling expectations for a deterioration in the financial sector's asset quality. Without even joining this club of doomsayers, it is very easy to engage in conjecture that we have problems in China in the property sector. Casual observers to China have seen rows and rows of empty homes and offices which are owned by speculative investors who are holding on to the properties not really to get any rental yield, but actually for price appreciation. Another concern is the reemergence of the so-called ghost towns, rows and rows of empty houses, again, unoccupied. Now, since so many of these concerns revolve around China's property market, investors are trying to understand just how much of last year's property boom was driven by credit lending. They're also questioning that these scenes of apparent building bubbles should be viewed, whether they should be viewed through the lens of the unique circumstances in China, or do they suggest an imminent collapse? So to answer these questions, we really need to take a look at the overall economic situation and lending growth. Now, if you look at this simple picture, this is basically over the last 6 years. Lending growth has skyrocketed in the last 12 months, going from an average of about 18% to about 33% in 2009. Recently, as you saw, lending growth has come off slightly, but this is still way above the average, or the previous peak, as a matter of fact, was only 23%. In absolute amounts, new lending last year was 9.6 trillion RMB. This year, our projection and the CBRC's projection is that lending growth will be slowing to about 17%. In terms of new loans disbursed, that number will be negative compared to 2009, basically 7.5 trillion compared against 9.6 trillion in 2009. So it appears lending growth is slowing. Also, in addition to the quantity of loans, the central government is also trying to control the pace of lending. Now, these bars are quite simple. They're over the last 4 years, basically indicate first quarter, second quarter, third quarter, and fourth quarter. So if you look at the blue bars, that's the average for the past 8 years, not counting 2009. So every year, 30% of new loans were given out in the first quarter, another 30% in the second quarter, and you can see 2020 in the fourth and third quarters. But 2009 was extraordinary because you can see 50% of lending was given out in the first quarter of 2009, exactly a year ago, because the Chinese government was very concerned about the global recession and basically urged banks to lend. So this year, the situation seems to have stabilized, so therefore, the CBRC, the banking regulator, wants banks to revert back to the old 3-3-2-2 pattern, meaning 30%, 30% each for the first two quarters, 20%, 20% for the remaining quarters. The reason is very simple, because last year this time, when lending growth became extraordinarily strong, a lot of that money actually leaked into asset markets, property markets, stock markets, and actually people use that money to speculate in commodities as well. I heard anecdotes about pig farmers buying themselves some copper and putting in the backyard. Just because lending was so strong, credit was so easily available, as a result, the money actually did not all go into the real economy. It actually went into speculation. And this is precisely what the central government is trying to prevent. Now, will there be a credit crunch? Because, okay, let me take another poll. How many people think, based on what I've said, due to the slowdown in lending, will there be a credit crunch among the corporate sector? Okay, no one believes there will be a credit crunch. You're right, because look at this. This line is corporate savings growth. It's now at a record high, nearly 40%. What this means is that the companies in China have a lot of cash on their balance sheets. The reason is because they borrowed so much in 2009, they haven't used that money yet. So the money is in the bank, and they're ready to use this money, hopefully in 2010, even though lending growth may be slowing. I don't believe there is going to be a credit crunch. Household sector, the story is slightly different. This is, again, deposit growth, yeah, for the household sector. That's coming down. The reason is that households don't like the interest rates they're getting. Are you happy with the interest rates you're getting from HSBC Standard Chartered? No, because it's near zero. Well, anywhere in the world, rates for the depositors, individual depositors, are near zero. So therefore, people are taking money out of the banking deposits to invest or, dare I say, speculate in the property market and the stock market. So the household sector is quite confident, while the corporate sector is cashed up, so no risks of a credit crunch. Now, we've said it, the CBRC is trying to regulate the quantity and the pace of lending. They are also using a combination of moral suasion, what we call window guidance in China, and quantitative measures to slow liquidity in China. So this is basically a simple ratio that the CBRC uses, which is the Bank Reserve Requirement Ratio, RRR, the amount of money a commercial bank has to have on deposit at the at the central bank. That ratio has gone up two times now so far this year. And interestingly enough, you can see the previous peak was 17.5%. We're now at 16.5%. So there's not much more scope for further increases in the RRR. What next? Inflation is picking up. As you can see, CPI, PPI are now back in positive territory after being in deflation in 2009. What that means is real interest rates, taking into account inflation, are becoming negative. They're already negative for depositors because if you deposit money as the current account, we call it in the West, in China it's called demand deposit, basically just loose cash that you have in the banking sector, you get 72 basis points. Inflation is higher than that now, so you're getting negative real interest rates. On the lending side, real rates are not yet negative, but inflation is coming back, so you can see nominal rates have stayed stable, but real rates are coming down. So in addition to that, there's not much scope for the government to lift the RRR ratio, as we just said. The next step will be an interest rate hike. And I think a rate hike could come sooner than the market expected, just like the two RRR increases happened sooner than the market expected. Sometime in the second quarter of 2010, we could be getting the first interest rate hike in 2 years. Now, these two graphs, they are very clear V-shaped graphs. The left-hand side graph shows you industrial production in China after dipping dramatically in 2008 and 2009. Now we've got a very strong recovery underway. Power generation on the right-hand side is even more remarkable. In the month of January, Chinese power consumption demand was up 40%. During Chinese New Year last week, 27.5%. So this is more than just a V. It's almost gone too far on the upside. So the underlying economy is extremely strong. Now, exports. A year ago when I stood in front of everyone, I had no idea that exports a year later would return to all-time peaks. I don't think anyone here last year imagined, even though I was an optimist, I had not imagined in the worst recession facing the world economy in 100 years, Chinese exports now have returned to all-time highs. That all-time high was basically hit in July of 2008. As you can see, imports last month went up over 80%. Exports, very strong, above 20%. So as a result, we have exports and imports this year becoming less of a negative drag on growth. It is actually going to contribute positively to growth, unlike 2009. One thing that's changing is the fixed asset investment picture. Everyone knows fixed asset investments, investing in power plants and factories and real estate have been the major driver for growth in China. This is fixed asset investment growth overall. Last year was 35%. As you can see, going forward, I think that growth rate will come down because the central government is very keen to contain the pace of investment the investment boom. So therefore, they're focusing very much on getting the existing projects completed, but as for new projects, approvals will be harder to come by. So as a result, I think overall fixed asset investment growth will be lower in 2010 compared to 2009. And this graph is a real estate sector fixed asset investment. You can see the dip starting the fourth quarter of 2008 throughout 2009, and now you have a V-shaped recovery in the overall property sector construction. But this year, I believe, first half, property construction will be strong because a lot of the projects were only started about 6 months ago. But going into this period next year, 2011, I think the pace of new construction for property will slow down quite materially. So having gone through all that, I do believe in 2010, the Chinese economy will achieve a better balanced growth picture. So this is for the past 4 years. This is 2010, 9, 08, and 07. In 2009, the situation was quite extraordinary. Most of the growth, we had 8.7% growth. 90% of that, 8 percentage points of that, came from fixed asset investments. Consumption is this dark part. And then net exports were negative, dragged growth down by 3.9%. This year is different. We're hoping that investments and consumption will contribute relatively evenly to overall growth, although investments are still slightly higher, about 4.7%. Consumption, 4.5%. And you can see net exports will contribute, once again, to positive economic growth in 2010. So this is better balanced compared to 2009, but I think we still, in the future years, hope that consumption will play a bigger part relative to fixed asset investments. Now, let me turn our attention to property. I began by saying there are doomsayers out there. There are people out there who are calling China a massive major short. I don't subscribe to that view. I do think there are areas of concern, such as this picture, which shows you this is land prices in China, this is property prices. You can see the two pretty much correlate very strongly. Land prices in China, property prices in China are all near all-time highs. And especially in 2009, the second half, most of the land sales went to large state-owned enterprises, which had so much cash from the banking sector. This year, I think the situation will be slightly different. I think the government will be much more prudent in scrutinizing lending. And also, secondly, I think property prices are not going to see the same degree of increase compared to 2009. Prices are too high. Property prices are too high. And in fact, I would even go so far as to say, in some pockets of the real estate market, the bubble has reached monumental levels. Just recently, I was in the beautiful city of Sanya, a seaside resort on China's Hainan Island. And it was very interesting. I went to visit a property site because recently in January, the central government said, we're going to make Hainan an international tourism center. As soon as that announcement came out, everyone seemed to have rushed to Hainan to buy a property. So when I went to the property sites for a visit, there was a long queue outside of this development. So you have to line up in the VIP queue, put your VIP name down, and put your VIP phone number down so that you're hoping that you will get a call from a VIP sales agent. I was just casually checking out the place. Within that half hour I was there, property prices, according to the rumor mills, people were kind of whispering numbers while waiting outside, prices just went up another 1,000 RMB per square meter. So, you know, this is kind of a frenzy. And then it was explained to me, Jing, you must understand the Chinese people. I said, oh, okay, I am Chinese, but please enlighten me. You must understand, we Chinese, we need three properties each. One for yourself, one for the parents, and one for the children. I said, yes, I get it. And they tell me, we Chinese buy the rise and sell the fall, meaning you don't buy low, sell high, you do the reverse. You buy something whose price is rising, hence buy the rise. You sell something whose price is falling, hence sell the fall. It's not very elegant when I translate into English. It's 买涨不买跌. So that's a pervasive mentality. I don't think this year you're going to see the same level of price increases in the property market. As a matter of fact, I think prices will be relatively stable on a year-over-year basis, 2010 compared to 2009, because first half 2009, we had a collapse in the market. So year-over-year, in the first half, you have an easy base of comparison. But in the second half, I really don't think we're going to get any increases compared to the second half of 2009. So because of this speculation, if you will, the central government has introduced several measures. One is 5% taxes have been reimposed on resale within 5 years. You buy a property, you sell it within 5 years, you pay a 5% tax now. 40% down payment for the second mortgage, third mortgage, fourth mortgage, etc. And also minimum down payment ratio for land purchases have now gone up to 50%. And finally, the central government has pledged the construction of larger scale low-cost housing to make more housing available to the lower income segments of society. So these measures have been announced, and this is why the market is partially reacting to these measures. And when I speak to banks, they're telling me that they're enforcing the 40% down payment ratio now on second mortgages and third mortgages. But I don't think this is going to kill the market, because in China, as you know, people have a lot of savings and people put down a lot more than is required. So the overall leverage ratio in the banking sector among consumers and property buyers is relatively low. And this is the very big difference between Americans and Chinese. In America, during the credit boom years, 2006, 2007, we all knew now what happened in hindsight. But this situation that happened in the U.S., I don't think will be repeated in China. Now, property transaction volumes, I said prices will be relatively stable. I don't see any immediate upside. Transaction volumes, however, will be down quite sharply. So in 2009, transaction volumes went up 35%, but overall value, because of the increase in prices, went up nearly 80%. But this year, we're forecasting transaction volumes to come down by about 20%. We've seen that happen already in January, and also even during Chinese New Year. People are kind of sitting on the sidelines a bit, because a lot of the demand was satisfied in December of last year. People bought properties anticipating measures to come out, dampening interest. So a lot of the demand has been satisfied. So therefore, you are seeing a very slow first quarter in terms of transaction volumes. That's on a sequential basis. But of course, on a year-on-year basis, first quarter this year compared to first quarter last year, the transaction volumes are still increasing quite strongly. But overall, we're expecting residential transaction volumes to come down by about 20%. I'm going to wrap up with a few comments on commodities, which are, of course, linked to the overall economy, global demand, and importantly, property and construction activity in China. So this graph is about steel. The red line here, this is the growth in steel production. This is another V here. But this V, you can see we had a collapse in steel production in 2008 and first half of 2009. And now steel production growth is remarkably at a 40% growth rate year over year. China produces some 550 million tons of crude steel every year. That's 50% of global production. And with all that production, with even larger capacity, nearly 700 million tons, prices, no wonder, can't go up. Demand is strong, no doubt. We said industrial production, car production, home appliances, housing, demand is remarkably strong. But production is even stronger, so therefore steel prices are going nowhere. Similar picture for aluminum. Aluminum production, this is another V here. I might as well use the same picture for everything. But this indicates Chinese aluminum production. First, a year ago, again, annualized aluminum production was about 11 million tons. Now we're at 17 million tons. And this, you can see the remarkable recovery in production. And aluminum prices in 2009 went up. All metal prices went up. Copper went up by twofold. Aluminum prices went up by about 50%. Again, from here, you can see the correction starting in January. I don't think there's any immediate upside for aluminum prices because of this overwhelming overcapacity that's weighing on prices. I like copper better. Copper, that was my favorite metal last year. I stood here and I said, copper is a green metal. Copper is needed for the upgrade of power grids and power lines and for the manufacturing of hybrids. I like copper, but now I like it a little less than I did because prices have gone up too much. A year ago, prices were $3,000 per ton. Now we went to 8,000. Now we're at 7,000. So this picture indicates China's imports of refined copper, huge increase in 2009, which propelled the extraordinary increase in copper prices. But from here on out, I think copper, just like other metals, is going to be relatively sensitive to any tightening moves coming from Beijing. I also like coal. That position hasn't changed. I liked it all year last year. And this one is an interesting story. This shows China's net exports. This 2009 was the first year China became a net importer of coal. And it was not a small amount. It was 100 million tons. And I forecast the 100 million tons of net imports into China of coal will go to 200 million tons in 3 years' time. The story is a very good one. You have closures of smaller coal mines in China, in northern China, Shanxi. You've got southern Chinese power plants in Guangdong, in Fujian. There's no coal in southern China. So coal always was shipped by rail to the port in the north and then put on barges and brought down south. But this winter has been terrible. We had sea ice, we had fog, we had snowstorms. So at one point, Chinese power plants in the south were stranded. There was no coal. So the solution, basically, is to bring in coal from Indonesia, Vietnam, and Australia. And I've been a very strong proponent of higher coal prices and higher Chinese imports throughout 2009. For now, my view is that China still has a lot more imports to come. Also, China is exporting less coal to countries like Korea and Japan, who then have to bring in coal from Southeast Asia as well. So longer distances and more quantities are a boon for bulk shippers. There may be a bulk shipping company in our midst here. Yesterday I had lunch with one of the CEOs in the industry. So that's a bullish story for bulk shippers in the region. And for Indonesian exporters of coal, Vietnamese, Australian exporters of coal into China, this is also a very good story. So now, having talked about the macro picture, bank lending, the property sector, and commodities, it looks like 2010 will be a relatively challenging year for Chinese asset markets, with the timing of the government's exit strategy weighing on investors' minds. Now, this is somewhat ironic. I think this year's GDP growth will be higher than 2009, and the balance of growth will be better as well. However, I think the performance of the Chinese equity markets, property and commodity markets may actually lag. The tightening policies introduced in early 2010 are negative for sectors that are sensitive to policy moves, such as real estate and banking. That's why the property sector has temporarily fallen out of favor with my clients, global investors, due to the policy uncertainty and the overhang of large capital raisings by the banking sector has been weighing on banking shares as well. However, I think the outlook remains quite bright for the consumer sector, internet sector, pharmaceutical, healthcare industries, which will not be affected by any changes in macro policy. If we take a step back and think about China in the global economy as a major contributor to global economic growth and a pillar of demand for commodities, China is one of the most influential pieces of the global financial puzzle. Now, there has never been a shortage of skepticism towards Chinese growth. And today, a larger and increasingly vocal number of observers believe that China is headed for a reckoning. There are certainly some vulnerable areas that we need to monitor very closely, but a careful assessment of China's economic fundamentals suggests that odds of an imminent collapse should be very, very low. So on that note, thank you very much, and I'd be happy to take any questions and hear your comments if you have any. Thank you very much.
Who would like to throw out the first question here? Over here on the side, please. Please introduce yourself as you and your affiliation.
It's Yadong Liu from Medley Capital. I have a question on real estate, something that you spend quite a bit of time on. I'm just wondering, what is your favorite indicator as to whether there's a bubble or whether the trend is going to turn in this sector? Because as we've seen, the sector is not that sensitive to macro policy. I think you yourself said it, whether it's 40% or versus 30% down payment. So that's one. Two, in terms of the relationship between income, average income, and the housing price, it's long been out of whack. So it just makes no sense to follow that at all. And even when you say the prices are too high, I mean, what is too high? It's right now compared to last quarter of last year, for instance. You know, it's probably we're talking about another 10% on average increase. But in last quarter, the demand was still very robust. So what has changed? Thank you.
There's no accurate statistic one can use to say the property market is in a bubble now. We're in danger of a bubble possibly collapsing. There's just no accurate numbers. We've been always in search of some index, a pile of statistics that we can rely on, but it's very, very difficult. So all we can do is to do the hard work, talking to dozens of property developers, property agents, buyers, to see what the underlying demand is. But what China has that other countries don't perhaps have is very robust economic growth and income growth. Incomes are rising very rapidly. As you may have all heard, that wages in China are going up by 20, 30, 40% in some regions. Although that's for lower-end manufacturing jobs, incomes are very strong, savings are very high, and Chinese people tend to treat property as a way to store their wealth. So there are lots of positive factors, but I also think, though, on the flip side, you have this mentality of gambling and speculation that sometimes sent prices to extraordinarily high and unsustainable levels. But my firm belief is that you will see high levels of volatility and cyclicality in the Chinese property sector. But if you ask me 5 years out, 10 years out, what the outlook will be for the property sector, it's a very, very positive one.
Over here, please.
My name is Xiao Dong. I'm from City University of Hong Kong. I'm a psychologist. I'm trying to figure out all this V-shaped development, trying to give a psychological understanding. I was trying, instead of my figure out, I want to ask you, what would you think is the psyche of the economic prosperity in China? Thank you.
Oh. That's a very broad question. I don't even know how to define psyche. If you mean that the overall mentality of the population, China has never been more confident than ever before. I mean, think about it, right? China has achieved such remarkable economic success over the last 10 years, 20 years. It is now nearly the second largest economy. It is by far the largest exporting country. It is the largest creditor nation. And Chinese people have a lot to be proud of. So if that's what you mean by psyche, the mentality, and the confidence, I think it's at a very high level. A year ago, I also put up a picture of Premier Wen Jiabao. I remember standing at this podium, this was February last year, shortly after Premier Wen's visit to Europe. That trip was dubbed the Tour of Confidence. I came here and spoke at the FCC. I said, look at Premier Wen Jiabao's picture here. He just came back from Europe. He did a town hall via the internet with Chinese citizens, the first time ever. So he, interestingly enough, was sitting at a table using a laptop like this, but the laptop was all in red. Red. It says www.gov.cn. Any problems, queries, direct your concerns to the Chinese government. And he had a young aide helping him with the computer, and he's 66 years old, so maybe not the best with computers. So the young aide was also dressed in red. And Premier Wen Jiabao said, there's nothing that's more important than confidence, not even money, not even gold. So if that's what you mean by psyche, I think confidence and the mentality of the Chinese people are at very, very healthy levels.
Okay. Why don't I throw in one while other people think of one, which is one hears of families allocating the purchase among many different people so that very few, if any, of the houses they buy qualify as second homes, then therefore require the 40% mortgage rate. What is the rate for first mortgages? Is it 20% still? And even are people getting a break on that, in which case maybe we see a disguised form of speculation through people getting lots of mortgages in names of different family members?
The rate, the requirement for first mortgage is 30%. But you get a discount if you're a first-time home buyer from the base lending rate, you get a 10% discount. But if you are buying a home for the second home or third home for investment purposes, you get a 40% down payment, and there's no discount anymore on the interest rate you pay. So you're right, games can always be played, you know, not just in China, but everywhere else. But I think it's not a huge cause for concern, because I don't think the leverage ratio in China is very high, because household balance sheets are very strong. Savings are huge. Savings, household savings alone, are equivalent to 80% of the country's GDP. The Chinese banking system, that's why the government keeps on trying to control liquidity, because the banking system is flush with liquidity, full of individual deposits and corporate deposits. So there are some games people play to get around these lending rules, but I think by and large, the new regulations will begin to have an impact on people who are buying homes for investment purposes or for speculation purposes. But it's also important to say the government is absolutely steadfast in its support for lower income families, first-time home buyers, and people who are buying homes for their own use.
Out in the back there, please, around the corner.
Jing, this is Eric Floyd from OSRI, an investor association. First question is exports. You said that exports had recovered strongly. Is that from traditional markets, which seems a bit surprising, or is it the fact that China has been targeting new markets for its exports? And if you don't mind, I'll just raise another question that might be in people's mind, which is, with such a dramatic jump in lending into the economy, and evidence that perhaps a lot of that lending then got used for unproductive investments into property, for example, to what extent has the risk of future default by various types of borrowers risen significantly? Or at the end of the day, doesn't it matter? Because if you think about China Inc. as a whole, with a lot of lending going to state-controlled entities, at the end of the day, it was just a matter of spending down wealth.
Exports, a lot of the recovery could be due to restocking. China has been targeting new markets for some time now, emerging markets of Russia, India, Brazil, even the Middle Eastern markets are now big recipients of Chinese exports. The U.S. accounts for about 18% of Chinese exports, the European Union about 22%, Japan about 10%, so the OECD countries make up about 50%. The rest is other, you know, emerging markets and intra-Asia trade. But the recent recovery in exports have been quite strong and pronounced. In large part, it's because some of the retailers in the U.S. and Europe have depleted their inventory. In terms of the asset quality problem, whether we're going to see defaults, not yet. I think, as you said, China Inc. as a whole has a strong balance sheet. I'm not very concerned about the asset going bad right away, because asset prices are still quite strong. However, if we had a replay of the 2008 fourth quarter scenario when property prices collapsed, when the economy came to a grinding halt, if that situation repeated itself, and if it were more for a longer period of time, I would be seriously concerned about asset quality. But for now, Chinese banks are facing a big challenge, which is capital replenishment. They grew too fast. You know, loan growth, as I suggested in my first graph, you know, was over 35%, and they need to replenish their capital. So therefore, they're probably going to raise nearly 500 billion yuan in the form of equity and subordinate debt in 2010. And that, of course, includes one large IPO as well. So that's a huge amount of capital Chinese banks will be seeking to raise in the equity markets and capital markets in general in 2010. That is probably one of the biggest overhang on the banking sector in the short term.
Over here, please.
Hi, Frederick Atting from a private equity firm called EQT. Another aspect that impacts the export sector is, of course, the RMB, which effectively has been pegged since summer of 2008. What's your viewpoint about the outlook of the RMB during 2010?
I don't expect a dramatic increase in the value of the RMB. The dollar is already appreciating against the euro and the pound, and the RMB has been quite stable against the dollar. So therefore, the RMB is already appreciating against European currencies. So that's one factor. Second factor, the government has other tools to use to regulate the economy, including further increases in the bank reserve requirement ratio, interest rates, window guidance, and other measures. They don't need to use a currency as of yet. So in the shorter term, I think the currency will be stable against the dollar. But I think in the medium term, we see gradual appreciation. However, it's important to note wages in China are increasing, especially among the exporting sector. So therefore, as wages increase, that's accomplishing the effect of an RMB appreciation without actually doing it. However, when wages increase, the benefits accrue to your workers. The benefits are not accruing to currency speculators. So I think letting wages increase for the exporting industries in the coastal region is a very, very good way to achieve the effect of a currency appreciation and benefiting the domestic populace and consumption without actually having to move the exchange rate.
Okay. We have time for one more question. Why don't we let Tom wrap it up, our president?
Thanks, Jing. I'm glad there was a psychologist in the room because we all know why you're wearing red. Given your
I'm always wearing red, different shades of red.
Oh, okay. Well, I, however, always wear black. When the China's banking system was insolvent back in the late 90s, they very conveniently parked an outrageous amount of money, MPLs, I think it was $1.4 trillion in these asset management companies when exchange gave them these imaginary bonds that were worth the same amount of as the MPLs. Those bonds were supposed to fall due last year. The Ministry of Finance says, we'll just extend them indefinitely. How long can that shell game go on before there is some sort of reckoning?
Well, first of all, they didn't say indefinitely. They said for another 10 years. Basically, this is a historical, it's a legacy problem. Back in 1999, the four state banks created four AMCs, asset management companies. They're parking lots for bad assets. 1.4 trillion yuan worth of NPLs were moved at face value from the Chinese commercial banks to the asset management companies. Over the last 10 years, the AMCs have been trying to resolve these NPLs by selling them. And I think they probably resolved 30-40% of the nominal value of 1.4 trillion, and the recovery ratio could be around 20%, 30%. So there's a large part which then basically became national debt. So I think if this was a one-time incident, 1.4 trillion China can pay for. But we all remember there is no free lunch. There may be free lunch once, but there won't be a free lunch a second time. So if the Chinese banking sector becomes more disciplined, commercially oriented, and be accountable for its loan decision making and its own profits and losses, this NPL episode will not be replayed. So of course we're at a critical juncture right now. Whether the NPL situation will be replayed, my belief is that I want to end the talk on a relatively positive note. I do think the banking sector has been reformed to enough degree that past mistakes will not be remade. So thank you very much for your time, and I hope to see you again perhaps in another 12 months' time, this time next year. Have a great year, everyone.
We'd like to give our guests something to remember the club by. Thank you very much for coming again. Hope it's not what we gave you last year.
Thank you.
Thank you all for coming, and maybe see you next Monday when Christine Lowe is speaking on the Communist Party in Hong Kong. Thank you.